When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
It's Throwback Thursday.
Hey everyone, it's Throwback Thursday once again here at Krista Makes a Podcast, and this week we're taking you all the way back to April 19th of 2021 when Blake Schwarzebach sat in to discuss the writing and recording of Jawbreaker's Boxcar. Our listeners really seemed to love this one back when it came out, and if you're new to the podcast and haven't heard this one before, I hope you enjoy it, and if you're listening to it again, hell yeah, enjoy it again. At this point, we're pushing 200 episodes of Krista Makes a Podcast, and if you haven't done it yet, go back and peruse through our back catalog. There's bound to be a ton of episodes you'll love. And if you've been with us since the beginning, maybe you want to go back and revisit an episode that resonated with you, or maybe just check out one you missed. And oh yeah, don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really means a lot to Chris and I. Okay, let's get to it. Your Throwback Thursday episode this week from April 19th, 2021. Episode number 47, Blake Schwarzenbach discusses Jawbreaker's Boxcar.
Hey friends, today's guest is Blake Schwarzenbach, guitarist and vocalist for the punk rock band Jawbreaker. Blake and I break down the writing, recording, release, and legacy of the fan favorite classic Boxcar, taken from their 1994 album, 24-Hour Revenge Therapy. The song Boxcar is one of the more simpler arrangements in the Jawbreaker catalog, but the story behind the song's inspiration is anything but ordinary. Blake shared how the song's roots can be traced back to the side of the road in France while the band was on tour in the early 90s, what the song's title is in direct reference to, and how pickle juice played an ever-so-important part in bringing this song together. For all this and much more, lace up your Doc Martens and let's jump into this awesome episode.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista Makes a Podcast.
Man, I was trying to think of how I was going to set this one up. I'm not usually at a loss for words, but you know, your band has meant a lot to me. My band, Less Than Jake, is from Gainesville, Florida, and you guys are just revered there. You always have been. As a matter of fact, that was the first time that I saw Jawbreaker was on Sunday, April 14th, 1996 at the Covered Dish. That was on the Dear You tour. I don't know if you guys played Gainesville before then. If you did, I was out on tour or something. Do you remember ever playing the Hardback?
Oh, yeah. No, we played Gainesville a lot. We always stopped in Gainesville.
I knew you did, and like I said, I, for some reason, had not seen you until the Dear You tour, and that's pretty crazy considering I knew that you had had traveled through there before, and as I said, you were just absolutely, like, it was almost like you were a Gainesville band to all my friends that lived there at the time. So you guys released 4 records, Unfun in 1990, Bivouac in 1992, 24-Hour Revenge Therapy in 94, and of course Dear You in 95. And the track we're going to be talking about today is Boxcar, which comes from the 24-Hour Revenge Therapy record. So if you could take us back, was this song specifically written for that record, or was it written for Bivouac or in between?
It's interesting that you chose that song because it's probably our least interesting song. And also the one that was like written in about 10 minutes. But it has been like a fan favorite, I guess.
Yes.
Kind of is a good introduction to the band because, you know, you get it all in a very short amount of time. And I'll tell you, my only recollection of writing that song was when we were pulled over in France on a tour of Europe. And I think they were doing a drug check of the van. And we had to wait out on the side of the road. And I was out there like playing a dry electric guitar, just coming up with this kind of angry nursery rhyme song that had been like pinging around in my head. And that began it. And then I probably nursed it along in my mind and memory. And when I got back to Oakland, I think I kind of finished it off.
So was that on tour for the previous record, Bivouac, that happened? Or
probably. I mean, we were always like one album ahead of our output in terms of like we would tour a record that wasn't released and bum out our fans every time. That was like, we were always playing the record about to be recorded.
Well, and back then you could get away with doing that because it didn't show up on YouTube right away and give away what your next record was.
Yeah, it's true. You have to be a little more cautious.
I did pick this song for a couple of reasons. There's some history between our bands that maybe you're unaware of, but we ended up recording a record with Rob Cavallo, and I was begging Rob in 2002 when we were doing the record that, because he had told me that you guys had re-recorded Boxcar for the Dear You sessions, and Rob's like, yeah, I'll get the cassette, I'll bring it in, you know, I got it somewhere, and he never ended up, and it wasn't until YouTube that I ended up years later hearing that cut. But the song, you know, even though you had mentioned it's simplistic in nature compared to some of your arrangements, which, as we know, just can get very jazzy and time signatures and crazy. And that's what I love about Jawbreaker. But this song still retains what I call your poetry. You know, the words in this song are just some things, and that's why I'm so fascinated about it, and I'm so thrilled to talk to you today about it. It's still, I call it your poetry that you meshed with your music, that there's just stuff in here. I'm like, what does that mean? It's fascinating to me.
Well, I mean, it's a pretty off-the-cuff haiku kind of observational piece, and definitely a response to, like, what I felt was troublesome about California punk rock. At that, within that year, you know, my experience of it, of kind of the scene and how it seemed to fall short of the vision of punk that I kind of grew up with. Like, I felt like it was a really petty and kind of sniping scene at times. Looking back, it's fucking beautiful, honestly. Like, now it looks great. I welcome the backstab. No one cares anymore. But back then, it really did feel like people would get mired in these little squabbles that were like so outside of the kind of project of challenging received wisdom.
Right. You know, and this podcast is, you know, we deal strictly, you know, mostly with songwriting. I don't want to get too much into this, but if there was one band that I feel that got unfairly treated by a scene that was supposed to be all inclusive, was Jawbreaker. I mean, I hated it for you guys. I hated what happened to your band because I feel like there was so much more to your story when you guys had, called it quits. I felt that, and it wasn't just your band. I mean, the cries of sellout in the 90s were just, it was crazy. You couldn't do anything without somebody having taking issue with it. Whereas nowadays, kids don't care what label you're on. They just don't.
It's true. Although I guess there's now we have kind of another, I mean, there's so many ways to cast aspersion on people via Twitter, via social media. It's kind of the same tone emotionally, but it's the issue isn't kind of, it isn't corporate sellout. It's more like you're a bad person or
right,
whatever. Yeah. But it's the kind of impulse seems to be the same, to like tear people. It's hating, you know, just tearing people down. To make yourself feel better.
Yeah, I never really thought about it like that. It's a very interesting and valid point that, you're right. It's taken to the form of Twitter and Instagram and whatever else is the new hating mechanism versus, opening up a zine and, they signed a Geffen. Oh, my God, you know.
Yeah.
So you get back to Oakland and with this song that you wrote on the side of the road in France. And what did the guys think of it when you initially brought it to them? Because, like you said, it is a little simpler for Jawbreaker.
As I recall, I mean, that was a really hot writing period for us. Like, that album, for the most part, seemed to just fall together. Although we'd been, kind of carrying those songs along for a couple years. Songs like that one just happened. And, like, Chris is such a great bass player. And Adam and I kind of have a real deep link, having gone to high school together. And we were just at that place as a band, which I'm sure you know and other band people know, is when you're on and people just like look at you or look at what you're doing and start playing. I think we wrote it, they wrote their parts almost simultaneously with me playing it. It was so direct. It was just like, all right, you know, GCD. Chris was like on it. It was kind of a, I hate to say, use the term, but it was like a no-brainer. Like, you're going to go, build, stop, climactic, mini break. Like, it was all kind of like good songs. I think it was all almost built in to it. Like, the structure of it was just self-evident.
Yeah, and you know, that is a running theme on my podcast of songs that were written so quickly that just seem to fall together just in a matter of seconds or minutes. Sometimes those end up being the best and fan favorites in this case of bands. So I think you mentioned before you were playing this song live then, prior to ever recording it.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we were. I mean, it definitely became a song that people got psyched about. You know, they knew, word got around the old way, you know, via mail or phone calls or whatever, you know, of like, oh, it's a song about like how you're not punk. And like that, I think that really appealed to people's sense of kind of how judgmental it could be, how, you know, that feeling of isolation that you get at going to a new scene or club or show, whatever, that kind of painful self-awareness.
Right. And when you came back to Oakland, or I guess when you were on the side of the road in France and you said you wrote the song, did you write like the guitar chords and the melody, or was the bulk of the lyrics there, or had you come up with those later?
No, I think I just had the verse, the kind of the sing-songy part, you know, so the chords and the melody.
Okay.
And probably the Killing Cops probably came about because of the French police rifling through our van.
That's so awesome.
I was never a fan of law enforcement, so it could have been any cops, but
yeah, the French police, I've dealt with them before myself. They're not the kindest. So
no, it was very it was very fierce at that time. Like that border in particular, I think they were really out to bust people for hash or marijuana.
Especially American bands coming through there, you know, they're just a red flag. They must have something in their van.
Yeah.
Do you remember when producer Steve Albini first heard the track and what he thought of it?
Now, knowing Steve, I feel like that would not be his go-to track, nor in fairness would we be his go-to band. We were just, you know, a band that he had time for and felt he could engineer adequately. But like, it's not an emotional connection that we, I love Steve Albini. I mean, I love the records that he's produced and I really enjoyed working with him, but it was pretty daunting, us being fans and him being a kind of, you know, kind of standoffish guy.
I've heard that about Steve. And for our listeners, Steve Albini's produced records from Nirvana, the Pixies, the Breeders, and many more. And I've heard, and I don't know if this is true or not, that Steve's more of an engineer. He's not going to really tell you what's on his mind as maybe a producer would someone like Rob Cavallo. Would you agree with that assessment? It sounds like he's just kind of back here a little bit.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he was very clear about that. That's his way of working with groups, is as kind of a very accomplished technician, like just there to take a sonic snapshot of the band. Having said that, he's bringing all of his kind of power as someone who like really, you know, knows frequencies and sounds to take what he thinks is the best portrait of that band.
Where did you record the record at?
That was at his house. He had a studio with like a control room up in the attic and the tracking room in the basement. So it was before electrical audio, like before his new, you know, studio now.
And he lived in Chicago, correct?
That's right. Yeah, we are.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we're going to get into the song now. There's a 4-second guitar intro. It's just a 2-quarter. And then from the 5-second to the 12-second mark of the song, there's like a volume swell. And I almost hear, Blake, and it's funny, I don't remember ever hearing this. And I've listened to this song hundreds of times. But when I went to analyze this and really get the headphones on and get into it, is there a piano or a keyboard underneath there? Like almost staccato notes going?
There isn't.
There isn't.
Maybe just some overtones.
Do you know what I'm hearing though? Like right there, like between the 5 second and 12 second mark before the vocals start, I swear I'm hearing like a staccato piano going or a keyboard of some nature, and which is would be very strange to think of Jawbreaker having that. But I guess you've cleared that up. It's not there. We're going to get into the first verse here, and I'll have you break it down. You're not punk, and I'm telling everyone, save your breath, I never was one. You don't know what I'm all about, like killing cops and reading Kerouac.
Right.
So I get you're not punk, and I'm telling everyone, save your breath, I never was one. You don't know what I'm all about, like killing cops. And, you know, reading Jack Kerouac, I get that, but I guess you said the killing cops was referring back to possibly the whole thing that happened in France.
Yeah, I think it was just a kind of, I mean, as I said, it's a very offhand piece of writing. And it was like, you know, hey, I'm about a lot more than just this little scene in the Bay Area or, you know, what your version of kind of punk rock or underground music is. Like, I happen to, you know, have radical fantasies and I like to read certain writers.
And what was that like at that time? I know that you guys were just part adored in the Bay Area, but you know, what were some of those things you were going through, you know, from people talking? I mean, that at that time it would have been in zines or just gossiping, you know, there was no social media.
The Bay Area has always been a kind of contentious scene. I think there's a lot of shit talk in there, and I think it comes out of Berkeley primarily, like Berkeley being a kind of seat of radicalism and discourse in the 60s, and a lot of the kids there grew up in, you know, kind of former hippie or radical households, or I don't know. There's just a tone that like makes you want to punch somebody. Sometimes when you would be at Gilman Street and some person would start talking to you as though they had your number. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm going to quote Adam had the best take on it. He's like, there's guys in the East Bay that just seem like they've never been punched in their life. And I think people who've been there, who aren't from there, might understand what that's about, what that take.
Yeah, and it's funny. It's funny because I grew up buying mail order records from Lookout, and you know, I had this fantasy as a young kid, as a young punk rocker, of what the Bay Area was like. Like you guys, 15, Crimp Shrine, Green Day, Mr. T Experience, that whole scene, like. I was immersed in it, absolutely loved every bit of it, was just enamored by the whole thing. And when I went there, you're right, it was intimidating the first time I went to the Bay Area. You knew you were an outsider, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard in retrospect to parse. Part of that is just being young. And there is like a, you know, there's always kind of a cliquish way of young societies set themselves up. You know what I mean? Like it could be at the mall, like whatever. So there was that kind of, and like Gilman was home for the people that really were there all the time working and volunteering. And so they made it very clear, like, this is our house, your guest.
Right.
And yeah, like that was, yeah, it was intimidating. You know, they couldn't be bothered really. They didn't care about your reputation. If you're from out of town, they're like, so what? You're hot shit in Gainesville. Doesn't mean shit here in Gilman, you know? And we got that, like, we were kind of from San Francisco, but also a little bit from LA. So there were a lot of people who were like, Jawbreaker, never heard of them, don't care. It took a while. I mean, eventually people like began to embrace us, but it was like, at first it was just like, can't be bothered.
This is so crazy to hear because I, you know, first started listening to your band 31 years ago now. And to hear that you were going through that, I mean, I just, as a kid, figured you're from that area and just, you're just gods there and everyone loves you. And that was my perception, you know?
No, I mean, we were very fortunate in that our first vinyl feature was on a World in Shreds comp, which was a Berkeley label with Crimp Shrine. And so we were kind of jumped in a little bit that way. And they liked us, you know, Aaron and Paul and Jeff like really liked our band. So we got a foothold in that way. Also, like, Gilman's kind of a transient community. At that time, it felt like, you know, a lot of kids who left home would kind of show up there and start working and figuring their lives out. And then that whole group would kind of sometimes move on. So it was never like a fixed, there were some stalwart characters, but there were a lot of like young people flowing in and out of there.
Interesting. Well, we get into the what I'm calling the pre-chorus, and here it breaks down to 8-note guitars. I really like how the feel changes there. And the lyric is, "My enemies are all too familiar. They're the ones who used to call me friend." And on friend, it opens back up to the guitars, the 2-quarter there. And then "I'm coloring outside your guidelines. I was passing out when you were passing out your rules." And it's really a cool chord climb that happens there.
I'm coloring outside your guidelines. I was passing out when you were passing out your rules. 1, 2, 3, 4, who punk, what's the score?
To set up for what is the chorus. But these lyrics here, let's break these down if you could.
I think it's more of the same. I mean, it's the, you know, it's the kind of rigid punk guidelines of the community, and that they're enforcers who thought like would tell you what was proper behavior and what was improper. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of a contradiction of that scene, I think, is that it was like, I think you were right in picking up on it being really fun, that there was genuine like horseplay and ridiculousness. And, you know, like, I think what drew outsiders to the Bay Area and Gilman was that it, from the outside, it appeared not to take itself too seriously. You know, with a band like 15 or Mr. T or something, like, it was a little goofy.
Yeah, it was. And at the same time, I don't know if you can relate to this at all, but, you know, a kid from Florida back in the day when all I had was MRR and Flipside and whatever my buddies got in the mail, the 7-inch that week to talk about. And this is before I even got to Gainesville. But my whole perception of the Bay Area was your bands were so much tougher than like East Coast hardcore bands. Like, those are the bands that people thought were tough and mighty. But you guys just had a grit, a dirtiness to it that I didn't feel present in other scenes. I don't know. I just always felt that there was, even a band like Mr. T, who was goofy, there was still this somewhat of a grit to it to me.
Well, I always felt I was drawn to the Bay Area scene because it felt more punk rock than the East Coast that I'd come from. Mm-hmm. Which was very much like rooted in hardcore at that point. And I just reflexively didn't dig the kind of jock culture of New England hardcore. You know, I love some of those bands and I went to some great shows, but like that was not my world. And yeah. I was never going to make it in that world. And when I was introduced to punk rock, it was much more about like art damage, you know, like kind of fractured and also very creative. And I felt like the Bay Area was much more about that, like classic punk in the sense of like make your own clothes and, you know, have shitty amps and it should sound chaotic and kind of barely hanging together. A little more mm-hmm. frayed.
Yeah. And it kind of goes back to what you were saying, that whole Haight Ashbury, the Berkeley, that whole kind of, you know, you guys weren't hippies, but, you know, you were doing a lot of the same things that they were, making your own clothes, making up your own fashion, you know, speaking your own language.
Well, we were decidedly anti-hippie, though.
Right.
Because they were pretty bad, man. At that point, yeah. In the Bay Area, that was pretty sad.
Hey, everybody. We'll be right back with our Throwback Thursday episode with Blake Schwarzenbach after a few words from our sponsors.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
I just smoked and watched you burn. Dreamed I was a master.
And now, back to our Throwback Thursday episode with Blake Schwarzenbach.
Well, the end of the first pre-chorus, the band is ringing out, and all of a sudden you just say, 1, 2, 3, or actually on the 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, the band rings out, there's a dead stop, and you say, who's punk, what's the score? And you know, again, such a simple lyric, but I've seen you guys play this live and you know what happens during this part. Every fist in the air, and it's just, it's it's perfect. Was, did that just come to you? Was it always that lyric?
I don't remember, but yeah, it seems like something that would have happened just practicing, or just kind of, again, kind of off the cuff, you know, the simplest solution.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Yeah. But definitely people found something in that they related to.
It's interesting. The recording is very raw, but I mean, the drums are very powerful, and where the guitar hits are. And when you say what's the, and when the floor tom and the snare hit on that part and the band comes back in, it's just heavy.
1, 2, 3, 4, who's punk? What's the score?
You know, and it's a full re-intro there. And then we get into verse two. And verse two is funny to me because early on, I knew what El Sob was, because Green Day had talked about El Sobrante, California before. And I always loved that lyric. And the lyric in the second verse is, got a friend, her name is Boxcar, cigarettes and beer in El Sob. Her hair was blue, now it's green. I like her mind, she hates the scene. So was Boxcar someone's punk name?
That was my girlfriend.
Really?
Yeah. And we had a kind of shared disdain for right thinking of the scene. And we drank a lot of beer together and drove around a lot together. Not at the same time, but, you know.
Man, I am... Sorry, I'm a little emotional. I'm like smiling ear to ear right now. A song I listened for 30 years. I never knew it was about your girlfriend. I thought a million things of what Boxcar could mean. And like a little kid in a candy store right now, man, Blake. I'm just like, this is great. So your girlfriend's name was Boxcar. So how did that kind of relate back to what the song is about? Just because she was there living this with you?
Yeah, she was very much, I met her through the punk scene, and I tried to impress her. I'll tell a little anecdote here. I'm pretty proud of this one. We went for Chris Bauermeister's birthday party up to the park in Golden Gate Park, off Haight-Ashbury. We hiked out to this island and climbed up to the top of this little mountain in the middle of an island. We'd stolen a birthday cake from Safeway and a big jar of pickles. And Boxcar was present, and I liked her. I thought she was cool, and but I didn't know her that well. So I drank the whole jar of pickle juice to impress her.
And it did.
It worked. Later on, I found out it worked. Yeah, that was just planting the seed. You know, that was like my long game. And then I kind of asked back after it, like, did she notice the pickle juice thing? And I found out that indeed she did. So yeah, it was cool.
That I did not at all think that I would have heard you talk about pickle juice today. That's awesome. Do you still talk to Boxcar?
We are a little bit in touch. Yeah. She's out west, so, you know, we haven't seen each other in a long time, but we're friendly.
Okay. Okay. That's very cool. We get into pre-chorus two, which is the same lyric, which I was almost going to call these verses, like a second part of each verse. But since the lyric is the same in each one, I'm calling it a pre-chorus. My enemies are all too familiar. They're the ones who used to call me friend. I'm coloring outside your guidelines. I was passing out when you were passing out your rules. Do you remember ever having another set of lyrics here, or having it changed up, or did you want it to be the same?
I think it was always going to be the same. I mean, okay. I used to try to never repeat myself, but this song kind of seems like a song where you do repeat yourself. I mean, it's so four on the floor, kind of straightforward.
And that's why I asked you, interesting you say that, because you listen to other Jawbreaker tracks and not a lot of repeating going on. Again, I've always likened you more to a poet than a lyricist, which a lot, you know, there's a bleed over there, but it's like poetry. And this song, I think, lends itself, because of the simplicity, to having this repeat.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's kind of anthemic, and you want people to, like, by then they can know it. You know, they know, they don't have to remember that much to sing along. Like, right. 1, 2, 3, 4 is pretty, you know, I think we can all retain that.
Well, we get into chorus two. 1, 2, 3, 4. Who's punk? What's the score? And it's funny. That only happens twice in this song, you know, for such a huge part. And again, I don't know if you need to hear it more than that, because it is so simplistic. You hear it and that's what it is. And after that happens, the intro guitar comes back in. It's just the guitar by itself.
Pray for who's punk, what's the score?
Again, I keep saying the word simple, but some of the best songs and catchiest songs are just that. Guitar by itself. And now we're into an outro. And the outro here is you're all alone, all alone, all alone on your own. All alone, all alone, all alone, you're on your own. And the song ends at 1 minute and 56 seconds.
All alone, on your own, all alone.
Don't think it needs anything more, right?
No, I think we may have had a little discussion about putting the chorus in again because we thought it was catchy and liked it. And then we quickly quashed that. So we're like, leave them wanting more, you know, like get out of there. It was right. So rare that we had a short song. We needed more short songs. Fans would tell you that in Europe, they're like, what the fuck, dude? Loss is los. You know, this is 5 minutes. It's ridiculous.
Well, yeah, you guys did have, for a punk band, some definitely longer arrangements. It wasn't in the two minute mark. This was a shorter track. So again, going back to when you recorded it and it was up against, because going back and listening to 24-Hour Revenge Therapy, this song kind of sticks out on its own. Was there ever a thought of this doesn't fit in with the record?
No, I think we knew that was a hit. We knew it was like, that was a big cornerstone of the record. Like we've got, you know, when you build a record, you're hopefully getting songs along the way until you feel confident enough. Like at around 8 or 9 songs, you're like, maybe we can start looking at studio time. Like we've got enough, we're over the hump. Okay. And I think that was a pillar of what we had. We're like, this is a solid bet. So
cool.
Definitely.
Cool.
It was always, it was going to be featured on the record.
And now the record comes out, and I know you had played the song prior to the record, but you said you think you did, but record finally comes out and now you're going and playing songs from the album. Do you remember this one getting a better reaction than other tracks, or was it pretty crazy out of the gate fan reaction wise?
Yeah, it was pretty instant. I mean, cause we're a little more of an obtuse band. Like we are, you have to dig, and to a newcomer, it might be like, I don't know what this is, but that one was very much like, here you go. And I think it was instant. People just like, they remembered it immediately. It was a little pop song, so they could just get a hold of it.
Did that reaction surprise you, or did you guys kind of know that was what it was going to be?
I know that it delighted us, and like we would have to hold it, you know, be like, all right, we need a winner at around track 8 or 9 in a set list. After, you know, whatever it would be, they're going to be
the 5 minute obtuse song.
Yeah, they're going to be like, people are going to be drifting away towards the bar, so like we have to pull them back in. So that was kind of our ace in the hole, like when in doubt, Boxcar.
Right. Well, that is so cool, though, because I've had songs that I've written, and I want to see if you can relate to this, that you're for sure that the fans are going to love it. And even the recording of the song's good. It came out, the tempo's right, the vocal's sitting right, and you go play it live, and it just sits there like a dead fish in the water. And you might try it the next night, and finally you just drop it from the set list. You're like, it's not working live. And then there's some times where you're convinced a song's going to work live, and it does, and it sounds like that's what Boxcar was. Like, you know what? This is a little pop gem. It's going to work.
Yeah. I mean, we've definitely had those other songs, but we're pretty obstinate. Like, if we liked a song and thought it was strong, we would just keep playing it until people either accepted or left.
Yeah, that's a good attitude to have.
Kind of like the whole Dear You record was a little bit like, we put that out and it just sat there like a dead fish.
Which is crazy to think, because you know, it's kind of what I call revisionist history. There's people now, it's like, oh, I love that record. It's like, well, you didn't love it then. Because I mean, I know fans of Jawbreaker that Dear You back then was not their favorite record, but now is their favorite record. It's funny how time has a way of changing your perceptions.
Yeah. I mean, I talk about to friends who do creative work a lot about this. Like, I think we as artists kind of have unfair expectations in a way that if you look at art through history, it's very rare that someone's art is appreciated in their lifetime. I mean, music's a little more quick, but nonetheless, like deep creative work, you know, you're lucky if anyone's paying attention. And so I try to keep that perspective of like, sometimes you just got to keep on the road and like, ultimately you're doing it for yourself. And
yeah,
if you're waiting around for people to tell you to keep going, like that, you're gonna run out of air.
For sure. Well, you know, you mentioned at the top of the show, you know, that you were surprised that I picked this song, and it was for me, it was more about the story, and I wrestle with this with the show, like, do I go for like the fan hit or do I go for the song? Like, I would have loved to have broken down Save Your Generation. The key changes in that song are just mind-boggling. That's the Jawbreaker that I know and love, and I love Boxcar equally, but they're completely different worlds, you know. I did notice when I was researching the song that on the 24-Hour Revenge Therapy 20th Anniversary Edition, there's an alternate version on there. It almost sounds like a demo. Is that what that was?
I don't know, actually. Adam would know that because he's kind of our archivist and has all the tapes.
It's funny. It almost sounds like the same take, but it sounds like you're playing through like a, I don't know, like a really bad tube amp or something. Like, it's just the guitars sound different on that particular take. And I do want to touch on the Dear You sessions, and Rob had told me, and I don't know if this is true, Rob Cavallo, I had asked, well, why was it left off of Dear You? And he said it just didn't seem like it fit in on the record. Was that the case?
Yeah, I thought it felt a little desperate to me. Like, the label really wanted, you know, they felt it was a strong single and introduction to the band, but it seemed kind of cheap to us to like include what was already on our last record. And our base would know that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they could go buy the third record.
Well, and it's funny because Dear You sounds so much different than 24-Hour Revenge Therapy, production-wise, everything. Rob's just a different producer. Sonically, Dear You, just it sounds way cleaner. I absolutely love it. But it's funny, the re-recording of Boxcar doesn't sound that much different to me. It's damn near the same tones and everything.
I know, it's true. And that also was another reason. It's like, we haven't changed it. We haven't improved on it at all. So why add it? Like, even if the guitars are technically wider, it doesn't beat the original. The original is like got all the spirit.
Yeah, it's funny you say it doesn't beat the original. It's almost so samey as the original that, yeah, why include it again? Why not just include the original, tack it onto the record?
Yeah, it felt like a cover in a way.
As everyone knows, you guys took a long hiatus, and I believe it was 2017. Was that the Riot Fest show when you guys came back?
Yeah.
Okay, and you're looking down the set list, Boxcar's next, and you go into it. What did that feel like? Because I know the place exploded. I've seen the videos.
Yeah, well, we did that first. And it was, again, kind of like the song, like a no-brainer. We argued a bit like, well, we could be like challenging and put something really hardcore up front for the fans. But then it just seemed like, you know what? This isn't like rocket science. It's people who want to see the band after a long time. And like, let's just start with, this is going to be fun. So it was a bit of a gesture of goodwill. And like, also, we just knew technically it's not one you have to think about that much, except for me like hitting my toggle switch to get to from quiet to loud, which I probably almost missed. But it was, you know, it's like it's a muscle memory song. So you're just like, we made a rule, like we're going to be so fucking terrified for the first 15 minutes of that set that let's keep it on shit we're really confident about.
Autopilot.
Yeah. Adam had suggested actually Save Your Generation. He thought that would be the killer opener. And I agree, like the logic was sound. It's like, that's a you know, that's a good way into a set because it's kind of walking the plank, just the singer and the guitar. But to me, that was a nightmare. It's like I suck at downstrokes, first of all. So it's going to be my like flubby, I do like up and down, even if it's supposed to sound like.
In front of 60,000 people at Riot Fest.
Yeah. I was just like, there's so much room for catastrophe here. Let's just go with like the balls out, you know, track. So it was a great, great opener. And it was, yeah, definitely people. I was looking down the whole, I didn't look up till 15 minutes into that set.
Yeah.
I was just staring at into my own mind, like keeping myself level and just keeping space so I could let lyrics come forward and all that.
Before we wrap up here, you know, in all those intervening years in between the breakup, of course, you formed Jets to Brazil. You guys had what I consider really, really great success. Many bands would give their eye teeth to have the success you had. But in the back of your mind, did you know that the legend of Jawbreaker was growing? Did you know that eventually you were going to be on stage again, or did you want to let the beast lie?
I really didn't think we would be back together. And I felt the legend grow because that was the first thing that hit Jets to Brazil in the face, was like all the people that didn't seem interested in Dear You were there screaming at Jets to Brazil to be more like late period Jawbreaker. In the beginning of that band. So it was really tough on my bandmates because they were like, you know, what the fuck, dude? Like, don't they know we're in a different band?
Yeah.
But it was just still a little bit of that going on. So, but I could see definitely like the legacy. We were a lot, Jawbreaker was a lot more popular after the split than during.
I've told people that I saw the band, younger fans of you know, my band that I'd see on the road, and we'd get to talking about punk music and stuff. And, you know, they never had a chance. They were too young to see you guys. And it was just, you saw Jawbreaker. I mean, people literally freaking out. And I know you had to have felt that, what I'm calling the legend grow. And then finally, it just culminates with you guys at Riot Fest. And that just, that had to give you, I don't know, some kind of closure, so to speak, on what had happened to the band. Because again, I feel you guys were unfairly treated by the press, by the fans, for going to a major. It was just uncalled for, in my opinion.
It felt, it did feel like a certain vindication, mostly because it was so joyous, you know.
Good.
But Riot Fest was the right place for us to do it. Just like the whole culture of that festival is so in tune with where we come from, and they're so about music and about having a really good time. You know?
Yeah.
So like they took great care of us. Yeah. And I think we all felt a little bit resolved.
Good.
Certainly like I love the feeling of walking off that stage after we just thrashed it. And like the relief was palpable between all three of us, like so much history and damage and joy too, but like a lot of sadness, you know. It wasn't fixed, but it was like, it was seen.
and I'm going to tell you something from the punk community. And I think so many years had passed, all those sellout and all that crap and everything that happened, that, you know, time does a certain way of healing things. Nobody in the punk community, nobody that I knew, everyone was stoked you guys were coming back. It was like arms in the air. This is a victory. Everyone's happy. This is not a bad thing. There was no shit talking. It's like, fuck yeah, Jawbreaker's playing Riot Fest. We were stoked, and just congratulations on having that resolve. You guys deserve it. You're absolute legends, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Chris. I appreciate it. If you could save yourself, you could save us all.
Go on living. Hey, I hope you all enjoyed this week's Throwback Thursday episode with Blake. I love the story behind Boxcar, and I love the idea that we got a whole bunch of interesting tidbits about the song that may have never been out there in the world before this episode. That's why I love making this podcast, and I hope that's one of the reasons that you keep on listening. If you'd like to keep on listening even more, and, of course, supporting Krista Makes a Podcast, head to KristaMakes.com to sign up for our supporting cast. It's just like a Patreon, and you'll get a weekly bonus episode, plus a giant back catalog of bonus episodes. We call it the After Party, and it's always a lot of fun. That's all for this week. We'll be back on Monday with a new episode. Hell yeah.
Step into the world of power, loyalty,
and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, this is Chad Nicefield.
And this is Justin Press.
We're the host of Making Waves, the Shiprock podcast, a part of the Sound Talent Media Podcast Network. We're inviting you to sail away with us on an epic journey in musical enlightenment. Every week, we bring you only the best artists in rock music and discuss everything from the cruise to the stage to the saga of being a professional recording artist. We'll have lots of special guests along the way, so tune in every week.
Your stateroom is available every Monday morning, so welcome aboard.